Well, we're ready for chapter 2 in part 2 of Needham's work, and it has to do with Charlemagne and the Holy Roman Empire. When we've talked about the collapse of Rome and so forth, and from now on, when we talk about Holy Roman Empire, we're talking about a different kind of thing that is in Western Europe. And the usual thing that's said about it is that it was neither holy nor Roman, nor was it an empire, in spite of what it is called. I think in some respects it is comparable to United Nations today. It was an international kind of thing. It was a coalition of various political entities, and they would elect an emperor. But the emperor himself did not have power to carry out his will, but had to work with other rulers within the empire. But it begins, that entity begins in the time of Charlemagne, and you'll recognize we have all these people called the Great. And Charlemagne simply means in French, Charles the Great. It's just the French way of saying his name was Charles. He came to be called Charles the Great. Now, going back to an earlier Charles, we talked about the defeat of the Muslims at Tours in French under Charles Martel, whose name means Charles the Hammer. Somehow Tom Reed at the seminary is getting to be called the Hammer. I think it's because of his insistence on use of commas in sentences and so on. But it's an affectionate title. But here's Charles the Hammer, Charles Martel. He stopped the advance of Islam in France. But then in addition, he encouraged English missionaries to go to various German tribes that were still not converted. And so there are a number of these. The Frisians would be from an area around the Netherlands. Some of you who are farmers know about Holstein Frisian cattle, come from that area. The Hessians, that would be from became the territory of Hesse later on. Thuringians from central Germany. And so these tribes were continuing to be impacted by Christianity. We're talking now about the 8th century in the 700s. One of the things Pope Gregory II sent a missionary by the name of Boniface to do this missionary work, and he became the Archbishop of Mainz in Germany in 743. And in 751, on behalf of the Pope, who at that point was Pope Zacharias, crowned Pepin, who I believe was the son of Charles Martel, the king of the Franks. And this is a significant exercise of papal authority. Here is a king being given his crown at the behest of the Pope and by the Pope's representative. When the Lombards, they're one of those Germanic tribes, were attacking the lands that were possessed by the Pope in Italy, Pepin came to the defense of the Pope, and then the territory that he conquered were given to the papacy. It came to be called the Papal States, and there was significant territory in Italy that was owned by the papacy up till the 20th century. And later on, in the battles that were taking place in the Reformation era, There was a sense in which the Pope was only one of the players with the other kings and rulers of Europe. Some of the popes put on armor and went out to battle against other Catholics, against French or Spanish rulers. And it was because the territory controlled by the Pope was not simply the Vatican or limited to the city of Rome, but there was this extensive territory in Italy that was under the rule, the political rule of the Pope. There was a forged document that appeared during this time that purported to be from Constantine. It was called the Donation of Constantine, and it gave political sovereignty in Italy and the West to the papacy. That was the thrust of the meaning of this Donation of Constantine. This is in the 8th century. That document was exposed as a forgery in the 15th century, so 700 years later. But in the intervening time, the papacy would point to that and say, well, we have the right to rule politically because we were given that authority by Constantine. And then Pepin had a son by the name of Charles, and he becomes Charlemagne. And he reigned as emperor, Charles did, from 771 to 814. That's a period of 43 years. And when you see a ruler that is in power for that long, usually points to the fact that he has a lot of power and is very effective because he's not able to be removed. And that was true of Charlemagne. Needham says he recreated the Western Roman Empire on a Christian basis. And I had a discussion with Bill during the break. We need to recognize when we're using the term Christian here, we're using it in a descriptive way historically. We're talking about people who claimed to be Christians and who were known as Christians. God knew their hearts, this doesn't mean a pronouncement that this is thoroughly Christian, but nevertheless, it was his conscious attempt to have the kingdom over which he ruled be a Christian kingdom. Our church has been known for saying that nations and governments ought to submit to the authority of Christ. In this time, European nations do that. But as we look back on it, we say they didn't do it in the right way. They didn't do it thoroughly. This was not what we have in mind when we think about what a Christian nation would look like. For most of his reign, Charlemagne was involved in military campaigns. He defeated the Lombards in Italy. He took territory from the Muslims in Spain. He conquered Bavaria. That would be the southern part of Germany, just north of Austria, and Hungary. And he conquered the Saxons, that were a German tribe, and forced them to be baptized on pain of death. Here's the extension of Christianity by the sword. Later, under the influence of his advisor, a man by the name of Alcuin of York, he ended this policy. But at the beginning, he had forced people to become Christians upon pain of death. In 800, on Christmas Day in Rome, Charles was crowned as the Emperor of the Romans. That was the title that was given to him. And he was crowned by Pope Leo III. The prestige of the papacy was enhanced here. Symbolically, it said the Pope is superior to the Emperor and gives him his power. This Alcuin of York had considerable influence on the culture of this time. He reformed spelling and handwriting. If you read very much from earlier times, you find they were not very careful about spelling. And people often spelled their own name in different ways, kind of phonetically, and weren't too particular about it. I have a genealogy of my family in this country that an uncle prepared. Gene and I share the same uncle, 10 generations. There are 3 different spellings of the name Spear in 10 generations. So people tended not to have standardized spelling, but Alcuin worked at that. He devised a different kind of handwriting with letters that lie behind what we do in our printing today. He revised the Latin language, and he promoted the copying and preservation of books in monasteries. He edited and made a new edition of the Vulgate version of the Bible, the Latin translation. He organized and promoted education. In his religious policy, Charlemagne ordered that there be regular days of public fasting and thanksgiving. And this is a practice that continued and up until, in some ways, the present time, but in a very different setting among the Puritans in England, they also had regular days of fasting and thanksgiving. Came over into this country in our church. It's falling out of use now. But we used to have a regular report in the synod called the Signs of the Times that was kind of standardized. It would have a description of the things that are good that have been happening. And then it had a section on the bad things that have been happening. And then the recommendations of the report would be that because of this, synod orders that during the first week of January there be a fast day to acknowledge the sins of ourselves and of the nation. And so there was customarily, some of you will remember in our churches, a week of prayer the first week of January. And one of those days was ordered by synod. How well it was practiced, I don't know, to be a day of fasting. And then National Thanksgiving Day was designated by this report of synod to be observed as a day of thanksgiving because of the blessings that were acknowledged. So this kind of standardization of annual days, or more frequent than that, days of fasting, days of thanksgiving, was put in place by Charlemagne back in the 8th century. He presided over church councils that were held during his reign. He appointed bishops and abbots to church and civil positions. He reformed the monasteries in his realm to correct some immorality that had crept in. He regulated the observance of Sunday as the Lord's Day. And he made tithes mandatory. Before this, tithes had been voluntary, but he made them mandatory. In other words, the tithe became a tax imposed by the government. And it was a tax not on income, but on land, and on the produce. It was paid in the produce of the land, which meant that landowners paid the tithe, but people who didn't own land were not required to pay this. And this had a long impact on church finances through the time of the Reformation. And people did not think in terms of supporting the church by their own offerings, but that support came from taxes imposed by the government. Where you have an established church, a national church, that's the way it happens. It's a little bit like in our time, paying school tax, even if you have your kids in Christian school or in home schooling, still there are taxes that run the operation of education. And the church was that way in these nations that were in which Christianity was the official religion. In the history of our church in this country, there's a long struggle about financial support for pastors, especially. In the early days, it was the practice that people were asked to make an annual pledge toward the pastor's salary, not toward the treasury of the church, but they often, and then they would pay their pledge directly to the pastor. Tithing in the early days in this country was not emphasized, but came to be a later emphasis late in the 19th century and on. So people might fulfill their pledge or not, and the pastor had to get along as best he could, often farmed or taught school to make up the difference. Well, said he was crowned as emperor by the Pope, but in his policy, he tries to dominate the church in all of these ways that I have spoken about. So you get this ongoing struggle and conflict. Will the civil ruler be predominant, or will the leaders of the church, or in this case, the Pope, be predominant? And that's an ongoing struggle. Charlemagne claimed for himself the title the Vicar of God. The Pope had the title the Vicar of Christ. And this meant that Charlemagne claimed that he was ruling by God's own authority. This is, a continuing thing in the church. The struggles of the Covenanters in Scotland came because King James believed in the divine right of kings. It was the same thing. He believed that he had been made ruler over Scotland and later England by God, and therefore to resist his authority was to resist the authority of God. When the iconoclastic controversy was going on late in the 8th century, this was whether images and pictures of Christ and the saints were to be worshipped or not. He issued an official position which said that the icons were not to be worshipped but could be used for instruction. And we had this earlier on as the view of Pope Gregory the First. And so Charlemagne lends his authority to that position, which was later approved by a council at Frankfurt in 794. As he often does, Needham has a section on Western worship here, talking about this period of time. And he says that at this time, the priests were largely uneducated and did not preach. However, they began to use what were called homilies, that were sermons written by other people. Now, to preachers, this is can be fairly attractive. You get somebody else's sermon, you don't have to work at it yourself. And these days, you can do that on the Internet. You can find ready-made sermons, but this is with a different technology, but it became increasingly rare that the pastor of a particular church would preach his own sermons. They used sermons written by others. There were different kinds of liturgy, and under Charlemagne there was a standardization of the liturgy for the Western churches, following the Roman model as to the content of worship service. And it became more and more common that lay people would not partake of communion. We talked earlier about a regulation passed. They had to do it at least once a year, but that had to be regulated. And Needham says this is because people increasingly had a superstitious awe about communion and made them hesitate. And also, in some cases, the priests required them to really examine themselves and be serious Christians, and many were unwilling to do that. There were two main doctrinal controversies during Charlemagne's reign, and one was over predestination. A man by the name of Gottschalk, who taught strongly a doctrine of predestination. He was a follower of Augustine, and he was opposed by another man, Hincmar, the Bishop of Reims, who led a council to affirm that God wills the salvation of all and that Christ died for all. So we have later on Calvinism versus Arminianism, but the same controversy was going on. This was in the 9th century. So it was a matter of ongoing discussion within the Catholic Church. Those who were strongly influenced by Augustine were believers in predestination. Gottschalk would be one of those, but as is not surprising, others disagreed with that. And then there was a controversy over the presence of Christ in the Eucharist. A man, it's hard to keep these straight because their names both begin with R. Radbertus taught what was called the real presence of Christ in the sacrament. And Ratramnus, about the same time, said that the elements were only symbols of the body and blood of Christ. And you will know that at the time of the Reformation, then this controversy came up again with the Catholics having their doctrine of transubstantiation. Change of substance, Roman Catholic doctrine that in the Mass, when the priest utters the words, "This is my body," that the bread actually changes into human flesh, the flesh of Christ, and that the wine becomes the actual blood of Christ, although the appearance of it is not changed. That's transubstantiation. The Lutherans developed a similar doctrine, which is called consubstantiation. They said the elements don't change, but the literal body and blood of Christ is present in, with, and under the elements. And so that's what's called the real presence of Christ. Doesn't mean his spiritual presence, but the presence of his actual flesh and blood in the sacrament. And that was the view of Radbertus. Ratramnus' view was closer to what we think of as the Zwinglian view, that the bread and the wine are symbols of the blood and body of Christ in which he accomplished our salvation. At this period in the Catholic Church, both views were tolerated. And really it was at the time of the Reformation and with the Council of Trent that the Catholic position was really codified, was put into place in the document, the canons and the decrees of the Council of Trent, and matters that had been debatable and in which there was room for difference of opinion before Trent were decided at Trent and made mandatory upon the people. And so later in the 16th century, the view of Radbertus came to be the official doctrine of the church. Well, just to say it quickly, by 911, that's the early 10th century, and after the death of Charlemagne and of his sons, the Holy Roman Empire disintegrated into many different regions with many different rulers, and so there was not a powerful single ruler in what was called the Holy Roman Empire. And even the papacy, which then lacked the support of a powerful emperor, was unable to give effective leadership. And this led then to a time of great turmoil, with attack by the Muslims, by people from the east called the Magyars, and people from the north called the Norsemen, or as they were called in England, the Normans. The Normans who invaded England were descendants of the Vikings from Scandinavia. The Norsemen became the Normans. But that's a part of a later history, and that's the end of what I've prepared today. I'm glad for any questions or comments. Okay.
Could you explain adoptionism again? I kind of missed that.
Okay, I didn't talk about that. I didn't know whether it would be clear or not. This is under Charlemagne. There was the condemnation of a heresy called adoptionism at the Council of Frankfurt, 794. And briefly, adoptionism taught that Christ was the adopted Son of God in his human nature and the eternal Son of God in his divine nature. Let me look at the glossary and see if it helps to make that any clearer. Adoptionism is the view current in the West in the 8th and 9th centuries, that's what we're talking about, that Christ was an adopted Son of God in his human nature, just as he is the eternal God in his divine nature, the eternal Son of God in his divine nature. This was condemned as a revival of the Nestorian heresy because it meant logically that there were two sons and therefore two persons in Christ. So probably simplest to think of it as a later variation of Nestorianism. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Well, we'll gather for worship tomorrow, which will be different from what we've been doing in this time. So we'll look forward to that.